Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
For joining us for the Denver Post.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Monday, June 31st reading of the Colorado Sun. My name is Andrew Post, and today we'll be reading the following main articles. 14 of the 18 Republican candidates endorsed by the Colorado GOP lost their primary races. By Sandra Fish and Jesse Paul. Why Lauren Boebert likely won't lose to a Democrat in November. By Jesse Paul. Essay. A century ago, Denver newsmen helped unearth the nation's biggest political scandal. By Jack McElroy. A mysterious monolith appeared in rural Colorado. Do we really want to know where it came from? By Parker Yamasaki. And much of Colorado could be pushed into drought by late summer, thanks to hot, dry conditions. By Shannon Mullaney. As well as following up with miscellaneous articles. To begin. 14 of the 18 Republican candidates endorsed by the Colorado GOP lost their primary races. The party's unorthodox decision to endorse in primaries divided Republicans. This by Sandra Fish and Jesse Paul. 14 of the 18 candidates endorsed by the Colorado GOP lost their primary elections on Tuesday, most of them by double-digit margins. The results are adding to criticism of state party leadership, including Chairman Dave Williams, who were already under fire for making the unorthodox decision to endorse in Republican primaries in the first place. Williams was among the candidates endorsed by the party who lost their primaries on Tuesday. He got walloped by conservative activist and commentator Jeff Crank in the 5th Congressional District. State Representative Richard Holdorf, an Akron Republican, who lost on Tuesday in the 6-way GOP primary in the 4th District, said the losses are another sign that Williams needs to be removed as chair. His election strategy, surrounded by this MAGA right Republican Trump endorsement theory, was a failed experiment, said Holdorf, who called for Williams' resignation after the state party endorsed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert in the 4th District primary. He was never the right person to lead the Republican Party, and in July, there's going to be a movement to remove him and the other executive committee elected leaders. To set a course for a new direction for the Colorado Republican Party, that's coming, and there's nothing Dave can do to stop it. U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert was the biggest winner among the 4 candidates endorsed by the Colorado GOP who won their primaries on Tuesday. She had a 29 percentage point lead as of Wednesday morning in the 6-way primary in the 4th District. The candidate endorsed by the GOP who was losing by the largest margin on Wednesday morning was former state Representative Janak Joshi in the 8th Congressional District. He was losing to State Representative Gabe Evans by 55 percentage points. Joshi moved to an apartment in Thornton earlier this year from Colorado Springs in order to run in the 8th District. The decision to let the Colorado GOP endorse in partisan primaries was made under Williams' leadership by members of the state central committee at a gathering earlier this year. All of the candidates endorsed by the Colorado GOP got on the primary ballot via the caucus and assembly nomination process. Williams has criticized candidates who gathered petition signatures in order to make the ballot. I think he should realize there's a new wave of leadership and that this is a referendum on him, El Paso County Treasurer Chuck Broerman, a Republican, said at a primary election watch party on Tuesday night in Colorado Springs, where Crank called for GOP unity. This is not the pathway to success. It's by embracing each other. A special Colorado GOP Central Committee has a meeting scheduled for August 31st. The agenda includes consideration of any special meeting petition, requests, or questions properly submitted, at which may mean an effort to oust Williams. At least 60% of the committee would have to vote to remove Williams. The Colorado GOP sent out an email Wednesday morning congratulating the party's primary winners. Primary elections can be tough, but now is the time to shift our focus towards defeating Joe Biden and all the radical Democrats who are harming Colorado and the nation. The unsigned email said, "Now is the time to come together to help get President Trump and our nominees across the finish line." Why Lauren Boebert likely won't lose to a Democrat in November. The Republican Congresswoman won a decisive victory in the GOP primary. In Colorado's 4th congressional district, her Democratic opponent, meanwhile, got walloped in the district's special election. This by Jesse Paul. If the results from Tuesday's primary and special election in Colorado's 4th congressional district are any indication, Democrats' best chance to oust Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert has gone up in smoke. Boebert's large margin of victory over her five primary challengers and Democrat Tricia Calvarese's walloping in the special election suggests that the Congresswoman will cruise to a win in November. Yes, Boebert nearly lost her 2020 re-election bid on the other side of Colorado in the 3rd congressional district, but the 4th district, where Boebert moved in order to shore up her political future, is far more favorable to Republicans, and the election results this week only reinforce that fact. Here's a closer look at the evidence pointing to a Boebert win in the fall. Boebert's primary victory was decisive. Boebert's share of the vote in the 4th District Republican primary was holding steady Wednesday afternoon at 43% as the final ballots were being counted. She won in all but six of the district's 21 counties. One of her county-level wins was in Douglas County, the district's population center. The district also includes Loveland and sweeps across the Eastern Plains. While she didn't secure a majority, Boebert's victory was decisive enough to indicate that she can consolidate support among Republicans. Her margin of victory over her next closest opponent was 29 percentage points. Eastern Colorado, a lot of counties got behind Boebert, said State Representative Richard Holtorf, an Akron Republican and one of Boebert's primary rivals. It was a surprise. I don't know what the motivator for that. Probably the Trump endorsement was part of that. That Trump endorsement carried a lot more weight than maybe I anticipated. Holtorf said he frequently heard on the campaign trail from voters who said that they would never back Boebert. But then, when it came time to vote, obviously people voted in favor of her to be their congresswoman. 850 KOA radio host Mandy Connell, who backed conservative commentator Deborah Flora in the 4th District Republican primary, said she's not sure it is an accurate thing to say that the district belongs, politically speaking, to Boebert now. I do think that Lauren obviously won handily, Connell says. But Connell said she plans to vote for Boebert in November. Even Boebert's primary opponents are already throwing their weight behind her heading into the general election. Former state senator Jerry Sonnenberg, now a Logan County commissioner, pledged in a written statement that he would help her to win in November. He came in second in the primary with 14% of the vote as of Wednesday afternoon. Tricia Calvarese lost by 24 percentage points in the special election. The 4th District is a Republican stronghold. Former U.S. Representative Ken Buck, a Republican, won his last two elections in the district by 23 percentage points each. The district's voters backed Republican Cory Gardner by 23 percentage points in Colorado's 2020 U.S. Senate race. Republican gubernatorial candidate Walker Stapleton won by a 24-point margin in 2018, and Donald Trump by a 30-point margin in 2016. A nonpartisan analysis of election results in the district dating back to 2016, conducted by state redistricting staffers, estimated the district leans 27 percentage points in the GOP's favor. By comparison, the 3rd district, which Boebert currently represents, was estimated to have a 9 percentage point lean in the GOP's favor. Trump's margin of victory there in 2016 was 8 points. Calvarese's big loss Tuesday to Republican Greg Lopez in the 4th district special election to determine who will serve out Buck's term in Congress reinforces just how favorable the district is to the GOP. Buck had resigned on March 22nd. Calvarese, a first-time candidate who previously worked as a speechwriter and an intern for U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, was trailing Lopez by 24 percentage points as of Wednesday afternoon. As she was losing to Lopez, a twice-failed Colorado gubernatorial candidate with a history of run-ins with law enforcement in each of the district's 21 counties. The AP called the race for Lopez on Tuesday night, just 30 minutes after the polls closed. Still, Calvarese, who is pro-union and supports the Medicare for All policy proposal, is bullish on her chances in November. She blamed her special election drubbing on a lack of money and name recognition. "I was running another race simultaneously," she told the Colorado Sun. The Democratic primary in the 4th district that she won Tuesday against a better-known candidate in retired U.S. Marine Ike McCorkle, who was running for the seat for a third consecutive time. McCorkle was the Democrat who lost to Buck by 23 percentage points in 2020 and 2022. Calvarese, who attended Douglas County schools growing up, emphasized her own ties in the area in contrast to Boebert, though each of them only moved to the district recently. Calvarese moved to Highlands Ranch from Virginia in October of 2023 to take care of her terminally ill parents. "I know personally the economic challenges that we face," she said. In May, Calvarese shared with Politico the results of an internal poll of hypothetical general election matchup between her and Boebert. It showed her trailing the congresswoman by 10 percentage points, 46% to 36%. The Keating Research Survey, conducted from April 18th to the 24th among 500 likely November voters, indicated that 18% of those polled were undecided or didn't know who they would vote for in the hypothetical contest. The poll had a 4.4 percentage point margin of error, and Keating is a Colorado-based Democratic pollster with a solid record of predicting races in the state. Something else to keep in mind, turnout in the special election Tuesday, about 33%, was much lower than it was in the district's general election in 2022, that being 62%. Another reason is that national groups are ignoring the race. National Democratic and Republican groups are so far ignoring the race in the 4th District because of this, it's a big indication that they believe that Boebert's victory in November is all but a foregone conclusion. That could change as Election Day nears, but if it doesn't, their lack of investment should breed as them writing off the race. Additionally, Calvarese hasn't proven herself to be a remarkable fundraiser. She raised about $100,000 from April 1st to June 5th, while Boebert, by comparison, raised $334,000 during that same stretch. While money isn't everything in elections, it is crucial for candidates like Calvarese with little name recognition who are trying to get their message out. Essay. A century ago, Denver newsmen helped unearth the nation's biggest political scandal. The story of Teapot Dome lends historical perspective to today's polarized and weaponized era of uncivil discourse. This by Jack McElroy. Media manipulation, piratical politics, corruption, contempt and crushed credibility in courtrooms. Old news all. 100 years ago today, in the nation's biggest political scandal up to that time, a U.S. cabinet secretary was indicted, thanks to the scheming of a Denver publisher, the doggedness of his immigrant reporter, and the courage of a muckraking editor. The scandal was called Teapot Dome, and its story lends historical perspective to today's polarized and weaponized era of uncivil discourse. The tale begins with a man named Carl McGee, who made a name for himself as a progressive-era reformer in Tulsa before his wife's tuberculosis forced the family to move to Albuquerque for its healthful desert climate. There, in 1920, he pursued a lifelong dream of running a truth-telling newspaper, buying up the Albuquerque Journal and launching attacks on New Mexico's widespread corruption. The exposés enraged U.S. Senator Albert Fall, who ran the state's Republican political machine. Their feud continued after President Warren Harding picked Fall to be the U.S. Secretary of the Interior. In that new role, Fall cut a no-bid deal with an oil tycoon, Harry Sinclair, to drill in the Navy's Teapot Dome Petroleum Reserve in Wyoming. McGee had known Sinclair in Tulsa and was deeply suspicious of the arrangement. His suspicions deepened when Fall started showing signs of sudden wealth. The editor began to investigate. The Denver Post got a whiff of the scandal, too. And in early 1922, one of Fall's secretaries sent a letter to a friend in Denver. In it, she complained that the Interior Secretary was giving away oil leases to cronies like, quote-unquote, kisses at a wedding. The letter found its way to Frederick Bonfils, the Post's publisher. But rather than pursuing the story, he sat on the tip and waited for a chance to exploit it. That opportunity soon arrived. An oil lobbyist named John Leo Stack approached the publisher and complained that Fall and Sinclair had cheated him out of an old claim he had in the Teapot Dome oil field. Bonfils agreed to work with Stack to extract a payout. The Post began publishing articles critical of the oil leases, and Bonfils dispatched a star reporter, D.F. Strackelbeck, to New Mexico to dig up dirt on Fall and Sinclair. the reporter went to Carl McGee for help. New Mexico's power brokers had forced McGee to sell the journal by then, but he had launched a new weekly newspaper called McGee's Independent. He had no resources to pursue the oil lease story himself, so he told Stackelbeck about the tips he'd received, and the reporter set out on the story. Careful not to expose his identity for fear of great bodily harm, Stackelbeck spent weeks traveling throughout New Mexico, investigating Falls tax payments, land purchases, and rendezvous with Sinclair in his private rail car. The journalist even delved into the long unsolved murder of one of Falls' old political rivals. On his way back to Colorado, Stackelbeck met again with McGee. All of this leads to what then panned out, and the reporter expected the story to break in 2 weeks. Well, it never did. Instead, Bonfils locked the report in a safe, claiming he feared a libel suit if the exposé were published. Stackelbeck was in no position to complain. He was a German immigrant, naturalized in 1905. His loyalty had been questioned during World War I, and now his wife was in poor health. He couldn't afford to put his job in jeopardy. Bonfils, meanwhile, proceeded with his plan to shake down Sinclair and Fall. In September of 1922, he and Stack met with an oil baron in a hotel room in Kansas City. Sinclair agreed to pay the Denverites $250,000 and give them the rights to 320 acres in the Teapot Dome, which guaranteed value of $750,000. But the truth remained locked away. Instead, Bonfils locked the report in a safe, claiming that he feared a libel suit if the exposé were published. Stackelbeck was in no position to complain. You see, he was a German immigrant, naturalized in 1905. His loyalty had been questioned during World War I, and now his wife was in poor health. He couldn't afford to put his job in jeopardy. Bonfils, meanwhile, proceeded with his plan to shake down Sinclair and Fall. In September, he and Stack met with the oil baron in a hotel in Kansas City. Sinclair agreed to pay the Denverites $250,000 and give them rights to 320 acres in Teapot Dome, with a guaranteed value of $750,000. The truth remained locked away. McGee soon took his newspaper daily. It would become the Albuquerque Tribune, but he continued to struggle financially. In 1923, the Scripps Howard Group came to his rescue, buying the newspaper while retaining McGee as editor and adopting his newspaper motto as its corporate slogan: "Give light and people will find their own way." Soon inspired the company's enduring lighthouse logo. McGee, in turn, told his new colleagues that he knew about Fall's suspicious windfall. A Scripps Howard editor in Washington, D.C. passed the information on to U.S. Senator Thomas Walsh, a Democrat who was bulldogging a Senate inquiry into the Teapot Dome matter. Walsh contacted Stackelbeck, who told the senator what he had learned, but the reporter insisted that his role remain confidential. Walsh would call McGee to testify. On November 30th, 1923, McGee told the Senate Public Lands Committee about the riches that seemed to flow to the Interior Secretary after the contracts to lease the naval oil reserves were let. His testimony turned to humdrum political controversy in a national sensation. In early 1924, investigators uncovered some $400,000 in payments that Sinclair and other oil men made to Fall. and another oil man made to fall, equivalent to about $6.5 million today. And on June 30th, 1924, a grand jury handed down indictments against Fall and Sinclair. Sinclair eventually would be convicted of contempt and spend 6 months in jail. Fall would be sent to prison, the first cabinet secretary ever for receiving a bribe. Bonfils, too, would be called before the Senate committee to explain the payoff that he received from Sinclair. The hearings revealed that John C. Schaefer, the businessman who owned the Post's rival, the Rocky Mountain News, had also received a payoff from Sinclair. Both publishers insisted that they had done nothing untoward, though the American Society of Newspaper Editors, a newly formed group, declared their behavior slightly unethical. Scripps Howard would later buy the Rocky Mountain News, and would display McGee's Give Light motto and lighthouse logo until it closed 15 years ago. The Teapot Dome scandal wasn't the end of the Carl McGee saga. In New Mexico, a vindictive Republican judge tried him and on trumped-up charges of libel and contempt. McGee escaped imprisonment thanks only to a gubernatorial pardon. Later, that same judge encountered McGee in a hotel lobby and attacked him. Beaten to the floor, the editor grabbed a gun and shot the judge in the arm. But the gunfire also killed a bystander who tried to intervene. McGee was charged with manslaughter but was acquitted. In time, Scripps Howard transferred McGee to Oklahoma City, where its struggling Oklahoma news needed jazzing up. In 1932, the Chamber of Commerce asked McGee to chair a committee trying to solve the city's downtown parking congestion. The editor had an idea. Why not build a gadget that could rent spaces to motorists for limited visits? So, he invented and patented the parking meter. The world's first parkometer was installed in Oklahoma City in 1935. So today, millions of drivers can blame Carl McGee every time they're forced to feed the meter. A mysterious monolith has appeared in rural Colorado. Do we really want to know where it came from? As a nearby coffee shop is suddenly inundated with tourists, the origin of the monolith is still unknown. Here's How It All Got Started by Parker Yamasaki. Bellevue. On top of a hill prickly with dry grass and cacti is a four-sided structure that looks like the sky, the hills, and the small crowd of people standing next to it. But it's none of those things. It's not a riddle. It's a monolith. Perhaps the 247th spotted worldwide since 2020. It appeared unexpectedly on Sunday in Bellevue. Northwest of Fort Collins, on the expansive property of Rob and Lori Graves, who own Morning Fresh Dairy Farm, a Noosa yogurt factory, and the Howling Cow Cafe. A cafe manager spotted the structure in the distance as she arrived at work in the morning, but didn't think any of it until a customer came in and asked to be pointed towards the alien structure. The Howling Cow has been part of the farm since 2014 and has become a popular cycling stop that serves the dairy's fresh creams and yogurts. As of Monday, though, it's become a gathering place for bagel sandwiches and hypotheses about alien life. On a chalkboard menu, drink names have been given an extraterrestrial spin. Order the Beam Me Up for a cold brew with a double shot, or a Radio Wave for an Italian soda with cold foam. The monthly ice cream flavor orange juice shake has been relabeled the Cow Abduction. Alien figures drawn on the menu have thought bubbles that read, beep, beep, bop, beep. They probably weren't just getting enough business, the one diner offered. Marketing ploy or not, the shiny metal monolith bolted to a slab of concrete certainly hasn't hurt business. By 11 a.m. on Thursday, a line has formed in the cafe, from the counter to the door, a dozen customers long, and it didn't let up until well after noon. A second rush arrived by 2 p.m. "Been busy?" a customer asked a barista from the line. The barista nodded and laughed. "Where's the monolith?" she said mockingly, and then she softened. "Actually, it's kind of cool. I just can't say that word anymore." Then she pushed a milky green beverage onto the counter and said, "Crop circle," she yelled into the crowd. The cafe's new name for a matcha latte with vanilla. Monolith number one. The Monolith Mysteries began in November of 2020, when a crew from the Utah Department of Public Safety was flying over remote desert backcountry counting bighorn sheep. They spotted an unusual metal gleam deep in a slot canyon, and they landed the helicopter to investigate. There, they found the first mysteriously placed monolith, a roughly 10-foot-tall prism lodged into the red earth. Photos and videos from the incident were posted to the agency's blog. Please don't try to visit the site, as the road is not suitable for most earth-based vehicles, the Utah BLM tweeted. But this was late 2020, 6 months deep into pandemic isolation. Internet sleuthing was at an all-time high, and the prospect of visiting a remote site in the desert where few people had been and were unlikely to be was simply too tempting. A subreddit sprung up, "Find the Monolith." The more than 3,000 people joined it to theorize about its origin and locate the Utah phenomenon. In less than 24 hours, a location was pinpointed and posted to Reddit. And some users used Google Earth imagery to determine that it was placed sometime in late 2015 or early 2016. To some, the timeline added to the appeal of the piece. It was still possible, in an age of satellite imagery and social media stunts, to leave a mark that went completely undetected for years. Less than 2 weeks later, after its viral debut, the monolith was gone, hauled away in the night by a group of four men concerned with the environmental impact of so many visitors on the delicate Utah backcountry. But while the men trucked the monolith out of the desert, something strange was happening halfway around the world. The same day the Utah monolith came down, a second monolith was reported on a plateau near Piatra Nemt in Romania. Days later, a third popped up in Atascadero, California. Over the course of 2020, dozens more monoliths were reported to monolithtracker.com, a mix of hastily placed copycats and S-class monoliths, or significant monoliths well made with zero explanations of appearance, according to the website's six-part classification system. The original Utah monolith and the quick Romanian follow-up are two of three S-class monoliths in the world. The third appeared in Spain in April of 21. According to the Associated Press, the Bureau of Land Management is still actively investigating the Utah case. In Colorado, three monoliths have been spotted and reported to the site. The first showed up in December of 2020 at the spaceport in Watkins. It was reported to have been fabricated by Bill Zempel, the owner of a neighboring Mile High Aircraft Services, making it a K-class monolith, or a monolith of known origin. The next two showed up days later at Sunlight Mountain near Glenwood Springs and Chautauqua Park in Boulder. Though their origin hasn't been determined, they are deemed as Q-class, or questionable monoliths, likely to be knockoffs considering their origin or appearance. Monolith spotting slowed down in 2021, and the site went all but dormant until March of this year, when one showed up in Wales. Earlier this month, a second monolith appeared outside of Las Vegas, but was promptly removed by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department just a day before the one showed up at the dairy in Bellevue. The Las Vegas and Bellevue monoliths have not yet been classified. I know a lot of people are in a hurry to get here because they're afraid it's going to disappear. I kind of hope it stays. I mean, it's kind of pretty. There are a lot of maybes that hover around monoliths. Maybe it's an ad. Maybe it's a TV prop. Maybe it was placed there by a prankster, or an artist, a mischievous neighbor, the U.S. government. Maybe it was placed on Earth by aliens. Maybe we're the aliens. Of course, part of the fascination depends on not having the answer to its origin, and likely the maybe with the monoliths is that maybe few people want to know in the first place. By Thursday afternoon, Graves was getting reports that some Instagram commentators had turned against the monolith. Not so favorable posts, one of the barista texted her. I didn't even know we had a picture of it on our Instagram, Graves said. Meanwhile, a steady stream of visitors made their way up the hill, took photos with it, speculated about whether it would be struck by lightning or start a wildfire. The baristas, for their part, were feeling worked. Despite having bumped their staffing up to accommodate the week-long rush, they were out of sandwich bread. A compressor was on the fritz, and we can't really sustain this, Graves said. I think it's going to be a blip. But until the hype dies down, or the pillar gets beamed up, the Howling Cow Cafe will keep serving up monolith matchas. Much of Colorado could be pushed into drought by late summer, thanks to hot and dry conditions. Heat has been on the rise. Even summer showers may not be enough to combat its effects or to keep the state away from drought. This by Shannon Mullaney. Colorado has seen an average water year so far, but looking ahead, climate experts say much of the state could fall into drought conditions and struggle to find relief. Colorado's very average snowpack has officially melted away from all 115 federal snow monitoring stations in the state as of this week. Reservoir levels are at 94%, just slightly below average, while precipitation was at exactly 100% of the 30-year median, according to a Water Conditions Monitoring Committee meeting on Tuesday. Heat, however, has been on the rise. Even summer showers may not be enough to combat its effects or to keep the state away from drought. Really, the entire state is at risk of developing drought this summer, Assistant State Climatologist Becky Bollinger told listeners during the meeting. A strong monsoon would be really beneficial. It would limit that risk of worsening drought, particularly over the Four Corners. For now, it's looking like that is not as likely, and it's going to be a pretty tough summer. Climate experts track precipitation, temperature, soil moisture, and other factors year-round to gauge water supplies and storage for farmers, city utility managers, reservoir operators, and residents around the state. This year's outlook has some of those water users looking out for impacts to fish populations, to recreation opportunities, irrigation supplies, and wildfires. Without much rain, wildfires will definitely be a pretty serious concern, said Adrian Berger, executive director of the San Miguel Watershed Coalition in southwestern Colorado. The period from October 2023 through May ranked in the top 10 warmest time periods across a significant majority of the state when compared with a 129-year historical record, Bollinger said. Areas of southeastern Colorado, like Lamar and La Junta, have already reported 20 or more days over 90 degrees. The Front Range has already had 10 to 15 days over 90 degrees, and much of the country is also likely to be hotter than usual for the rest of the summer, she said. It's quite the switch after last year, which started out with cooler-than-average months, Bollinger said. The hotter temperatures are likely to continue for the rest of the summer. Western Colorado and the Four Corners area have a 70 to 80% chance of above-average temperatures, a very high degree of confidence, Bollinger said. Colorado's stream and river levels are receding after a normal runoff year, and incoming precipitation will be increasingly helpful for water users in the late summer and early fall. Although the state has seen average precipitation so far, there's a 40 to 50% chance that rainfall will tumble below normal levels for July through September. Some areas, like Fort Collins and Burlington, have seen less than average rainfall so far. Even with some rain in the near-term forecast for early July, it will be hard for those areas to end the water year, which closes on September 30th, at the average level, Bollinger said. The combination of hot and dry weather could make it harder for areas of the state that are already experiencing drought conditions to recover, and it could mean that more areas fall into drought, she said. About 16% of the state is experiencing drought conditions currently. That is vastly better than in the late 2020 and early 2021, when the entire state was in drought and over 20% was in the most severe drought category. At that level, agricultural and recreational economic losses are large, reservoirs are low, large fires can develop, and mandatory water restrictions are often implemented, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. There is a slightly increased risk for drier extremes in the southern part of the state, which really means there would be a low likelihood that any drought that worsens or develops in the summer is not going to see relief through the fall, Bollinger said. In the upper Rio Grande River Basin, aquatic biologist Estevan Vigil is keeping an eye on the water temperatures and water levels on the Rio Grande and Conejos Rivers for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Brown trout and rainbow trout flourish when water is about 50 degrees, but struggle when it rises above 70 degrees. At that level, their immune systems become stressed, and catch-and-release fishing can lead to higher fish mortality. If stream levels fall below 50% of the norm, and if temperatures rise above 70 degrees, Vigil may implement voluntary or emergency fishing closures. In the San Luis Valley since 2019, we've probably done it twice, Vigil said, and I'm anticipating having to do it this year again. A strong monsoon season would help keep rivers flowing and fishing access open, he said. Several city water managers said their reservoir storage supplies were looking good during the water conditions meeting. Colorado Springs Utilities reservoirs were at 85% of their capacity, and Denver Water's reservoirs were 97% full. The lack of monsoons would heighten concerns over wildfire risk or lead to a shorter rafting season for boaters, Berger said. Less than average rainfall could also leave sections of the river dry as water gets pulled out for other uses, like irrigation or for municipal supplies. Water users in the San Miguel River Basin know how to endure fluctuating supplies, Berger said. What we're looking at here is not amazing, but it's something that we're pretty used to down here. Without much rain, wildfire will definitely be a pretty serious concern as well. Xcel Energy says it needs $1.9 billion to prevent future wildfires as it faces nearly 300 lawsuits over the Marshall Fire. The utility filed its wildfire mitigation plan with the Colorado regulators on Thursday. Facing nearly 300 lawsuits over a wildfire that destroyed 1,084 homes and killed two people, Xcel Energy on Thursday filed a $1.9 billion wildfire mitigation plan aimed at preventing future blazes. Among the initiatives in a three-year-long plan are adding hundreds of weather stations and cameras, adding technology to more precisely target planned outages, replacing outdated equipment, and increasing line inspections by radar drones. These investments are designed to mitigate a risk, Robert Kenny, CEO of Xcel Energy's Colorado subsidiary, said in an interview. We are trying to do everything that we can to tackle this problem and to keep our customers safe. The plan, which must be approved by the Colorado Public Utilities Commission, would increase the average residential customer's bill by 9%, or $8.88 a month. Utility-sparked wildfires are becoming more common as power lines are vulnerable to high temperatures and extreme weather, particularly in the West, where recent fires in Texas, California, Oregon, and Colorado have caused billions of dollars in damage. The Marshall Fire, driven by high winds on December 30th, 2021, swept through unincorporated Boulder County, Superior, and Louisville, destroying homes and businesses and causing $2 billion in property damage. Boulder County officials determined that sparks from an unmoored Xcel Energy power line was one source of the fire. The utility disputes that finding. In February, Xcel Energy acknowledged that its equipment likely started the Smokehouse Creek Fire in the Texas Panhandle. The $1.2 million acre fire was the largest in the state's history. By the end of 2023, about 280 Marshall Fire lawsuits had been filed against Xcel Energy, including ones by Target Corporation, the Boulder School Valley District, the governments of Superior and Louisville, and 150 insurance companies covering affected homeowners. The challenge for utility developing wildfire mitigation plans is that this is a new exercise, says Kyrie Baker, an assistant professor of systems engineering at the University of Colorado. There are a lot of hard decisions to be made without precedent, Baker said. There is no roadmap for wildfire mitigation. It's going to be a different case for each utility in the state. Colorado is unique. Our situation is unique. We're a bit more sensitive to wildfire, and we have a lot more infrastructure around nature, she said. Looking at Xcel Energy's brief outline of initiatives, Baker said, some of the upgrades are necessary. I don't know about $1.9 billion. It sounds like a lot. But a utility faces the problem of balancing risk and capital expenditures. What if you miss one line? What if that one downed line causes a fire that destroys 1,000 homes? Baker said. It's like a PR nightmare. It's hard to put a price on reliability and resiliency, she said. Xcel Energy ranks its wildfire risk areas in three tiers. About 235,000 customers live in Tier 3, the areas with the most fire risk. Another 320,000 live in Tier 2, places with the next highest fire risk. And the utility has a total of 1.6 million electricity customers. The 2025-27 plan expands on an earlier company wildfire mitigation plan and has six key components. The first one, installing weather stations and wildfire detection cameras for greater situational awareness. Second, increasing the frequency of technology-enabled inspections of our poles and equipment. Third, implementing infrastructure improvements such as targeted undergrounding of power lines, equipment upgrades, and major transmission line rebuilds. Fourth, accelerating and expanding vegetation management near our infrastructure. Fifth, adding new equipment and technology to expand the use of our enhanced power line safety settings program and improve the ability of our facilities to react to wildfire risk events. And the sixth, a comprehensive public safety power shutoff program, including backup energy rebate programs, improved interactive outage maps, and active work to educate, prepare, and support customers for potential outage events. The last two elements will help the utility to be more effective and more surgical in shutting down power lines during extreme weather events, such as high wind storms or other similar events, to reduce fire risk, said Ann Sherwood, the Area Vice President for Wildfire Mitigation. In April, Xcel Energy shut down part of its grid to reduce fire risk in the face of high winds. It was the first time utility used such a planned outage, but with inadequate notice and information available, the shutdown caused chaos and prompted a PUC investigation. Xcel Energy said it may use planned shutoffs in the future. A starting point has to be trust between the utility and the customer. Baker said, adding that the better information has to be available in order to achieve this trust. The proposed $1.9 billion wildfire mitigation plan comes after the PUC greenlighted a $440 million Xcel Energy clean heat plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions, a $264 million transportation electrification plan, and a $12 billion clean energy plan to build renewable energy generation. All those plans will be paid for by customers through their bills. As for the $1.9 billion for wildfire mitigation, Keeney said that over 3 years it comes to less than 30 cents a day on a customer's bill, and that is adding some pretty sophisticated equipment that is going to make it safer and more reliant and more resilient. We're extracting a lot of value for that $1.9 billion, he said. And traffic is set to be allowed on U.S. 50 bridge over Blue Mesa Reservoir starting on July 3rd. Emergency vehicles and those traveling in smaller vehicles can begin crossing the middle bridge on Wednesday before July 4th weekend. By Olivia Prenzel. The U.S. 50 bridge over Blue Mesa Reservoir will temporarily reopen for the July 4th weekend, restoring a critical route across Colorado for holiday travel, while repairs along the middle span continue, officials said on Thursday. Emergency vehicles and those traveling in smaller vehicles can begin crossing Middle Bridge west of Gunnison at 6:30 a.m. on Wednesday, the Colorado Department of Transportation said, announcing the completion of the first phase of repairs of the bridge that shut down on April 18th. The bridge will be open 12 hours a day through the holiday weekend. But starting July 8th, the bridge will open just twice daily as crews continue to work on repairs. July 3rd through July 7th, a pilot car will guide cars in each direction across the bridge from 6:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m., CDOT said. After the holiday weekend, pilot cars will lead single-direction traffic across the bridge in alternating directions from 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Passenger cars, pickup trucks, vans, motorcycles, and emergency vehicles will be allowed over the bridge, CDOT said. Heavier vehicles, including campers and RVs, trucks pulling trailers, semi-trucks, and buses, will be required to take the County Road's 26 detour. Crews completed the first of the two stages of critical repairs on the horizontal part of an L-shaped beam along the central span of the bridge, where inspectors found a 3-inch crack in the structural steel, CDOT said. The unexpected shutdown of the bridge, which serves as a critical link for Montrose, Gunnison, and Hinsdale counties, left residents scrambling for solutions to get to school, to work, and to doctor's appointments. Construction teams working from scaffolding suspended from the side of the bridge started the process of bolting four plates in four parts of the bridge on June 12th, CDOT said. The first phase of repairs addressed parts of the bridge that posed an imminent risk to the structural integrity, the agency said. Each steel plate is about 23 feet long, 2.5 feet wide, and 2.5 inches thick, and weighs 9,000 pounds. More than 200 bolts were needed to secure each plate in place. The shutdown of the bridge came at the urging of federal highway officials in April, after crews found the crack during a mandatory inspection of the high-strength steel bridge. The inspection was required because of known issues with similarly constructed bridges around the country. CDOT identified five potentially problematic bridges across the state that used T1 steel. Further inspection revealed that there were three that fit the federal criteria for further action: two bridges over Blue Mesa and one in Bent County. Crews will look at potential repairs for the smaller Lake Fork Bridge, about 2 miles west of the middle bridge, and install strain gauge sensors to monitor the effect of traffic loading on the structure, CDOT said. Traffic will be reduced to a single lane starting Friday through Monday from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. as teams install the sensors themselves. The Bent County Bridge is small and low to the ground and was quickly inspected. It was deemed safe in 2023. And with that, we thank you very much for your time. Once again, my name is Andrew Post, and this has been the Colorado Sun.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.